The following has been recorded at Cairn University. Any reproduction of this recording without the express permission of the university is prohibited.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here, and thank you, Jonathan, for sparing me. You never know what younger brothers are going to say when they introduce you. It's really great to be back here. I was happy when I was asked to come back. This is the first time I've really been on this stage since I graduated in 1992. And I guess if I had one complaint, it would be that I live in Chicago, and so here I get a chance to come back to Philadelphia for the first time in a while, and it's the bye week. I mean, I could have gotten more Eagles than I got. In any case. What I want to do today is speak to you about my research on the Philistines. I've been working on them really since I left Philadelphia College of Bible in 1992, and I'm going to talk more about my technical research a little bit later this afternoon, but today I wanted to give you a little bit of the payoff. I wanted to sort of talk to you about sort of the theological implications of the work that I've done on the Philistines, and to do that, I want to connect really the work I've done on the ancient Philistines with the modern idea of a Philistine or Philistinism. If you were to search on Google for Philistine, you'd find all kinds of things, everything from a critique of our therapy-driven culture all the way to a review of Radiohead. I mean, really anything goes when it comes to Philistine. And I suppose that's not so strange for a biblical term, given that the Bible is both this ancient document and really a modern cultural and religious icon. But still, few terms have a twist in meaning that is quite so ironic. The story of the modern Philistines, it is said, began in 1693 in a German university town. In the German university town, the young scholars, in many cases preparing for ministry, went out one evening to the local bar, and perhaps having gotten everything a little ahead of them, they got into a large fight with the people of the town and were chased back to the university by the people of the town. When the administrative chaplain heard about this event, he quickly changed his sermon topic, and he changed it to the story of Samson and Delilah, which I think would be a good sermon to preach to young students who had had too much to drink, right? It sort of is a cautionary tale, but that's not the direction that the chaplain took. Instead, he said, these people of the university, these young men, were sort of the Israelites in the story, God-fearing young men, and the townies, these sort of uncouth louts, were the Philistines, and really they had done wrong. They had done wrong by these students. And I don't even know if that was a fair reading of the bar fight, certainly not very good exegesis, but it introduced the term Philister or Philistine into the undergraduate German vocabulary as a person who was unlettered, a person who was uninformed, or perhaps even with a daft old professor, you could imagine being called a Philistine in his case too because he wasn't keeping up with the latest research. This term, Philistine, came into modern English usage in a slightly different way. A little bit later in the 19th century, the influential writer Matthew Arnold was talking about English society and the English class system, and he wrote a few things. He said, there are three classes in England. There's the barbarians, the upper class, who seem to like honors and consideration. There is the middle class, or Philistines. They like fanaticism, business, and money-making, and perhaps in their more relaxed selves, comfort and tea meetings. And then he said there's the lower class, or the populace, that likes bawling, hustling, smashing, and beer. So he was sort of dividing society into those classes, but when he came to the United States, he said the entire country is a nation of Philistines, an entirely middle-class country. Now, I think he may have underestimated our love of bowling, hustling, and beer, but this was the 19th century, after all. And he thought, along with his contemporary John Henry Newman, that really what we needed to solve this question of Philistinism for the middle class was something that Newman called the liberal arts. He described it this way: liberal education makes not the Christian, not the Catholic, but the gentleman. It is well to be a gentleman, to have a cultivated intellect, a delicate taste, a candid, equitable, dispassionate mind, a noble and courteous bearing in the conduct of life. These are the qualities of a large knowledge. They are the objects of a university. And so Matthew Arnold and John Henry Newman are using this idea of education and the university in order to develop minds so that people are not Philistines. Matthew Arnold stated it this way: we are to know ourselves and the world, to know the best which has been thought and said in the world, or culture is and ought to be the study and pursuit of perfection. And if you hear sort of Platonic overtones in such a statement, it's intentional. He really does sort of draw on Plato's Republic and see a society in which each person sort of acts in accordance with their nature, with the philosophers in charge. And through it all, a knowledge of the classics, the best of every civilization, should guide the student on the proper path to critical thinking. Toward the end of one of his famous works, Culture and Anarchy, Matthew Arnold compared two ways of moving forward. He said there was Hebraism, or right doing, and Hellenism, or right thinking. Both, he said, move one forward to perfection or salvation, but with very different methods. Hebraism and its laws and rules and religious fervor, sometimes it's necessarily dominant, but Arnold longed for the best of all things, both in thought and action. And really, if you read his writings, it's the thought that ends up being dominant. He really wants this Hellenism, this sweetness and light, as he describes it, to win the day. He said that if you just have right actions, he thought, it devolved into ignorance. He has this famous statement, no man who knows nothing else knows even his Bible. He really felt that this broader education was critical to understanding the right way to live. And in all these ways, he was trying to keep people from being Philistines. This idea of Philistinism as sort of this elitist endeavor where connoisseurship was the order of the day is really one of the ways in which it has come into our language more commonly. The Oxford English Dictionary defines one meaning of Philistine in this way, an uneducated or unenlightened person, one perceived to be indifferent or hostile to art or culture, or whose interests or tastes are commonplace or material, a person who is not a connoisseur. And taking this again back into theology, Karl Barth captured the sentiment in this way. He wrote, theology is a peculiarly beautiful discipline. Indeed, at this point, we may refer to the fact that if its task is correctly understood, theology as a whole, in its parts and in their interconnection, in its content and method, apart from anything else, is a peculiarly beautiful science. Indeed, we can confidently say it is the most beautiful of all the sciences. To find the sciences distasteful is the mark of the Philistine. It is an extreme form of Philistinism to find or be able to find theology distasteful. In the 20th century, there was another way in which the term Philistine came into our thought. Nietzsche had argued in the 19th century that that connoisseurship wasn't enough. Education wasn't enough. You needed to continue to have sort of the spark of learning behind it. There needed to be life behind your appreciation of art or music or other things. And this idea was picked up by Hannah Arendt in particular, as she was trying to reflect on how such an educated society as 1920s and 1930s Germany did the things that they did. And so she said, really, they were educated Philistines. They had all this knowledge, but they had lost sort of the spark of learning. And so in that way, they had still lapsed into the Philistinism that we want to avoid. I mean, as you can see, this idea of Philistine is entirely negative. This concept brings its way into Christian education as well. There's a relatively influential book of the mid-20th century, Arthur Holmes' Idea of a Christian College. And in this book, he describes his model student, Pat, as widely read. She has read Plato and Augustine, Shakespeare and Faulkner. She is acquainted with both Bach and Bartok and enjoys Monet and Picasso. He goes on to describe the judicious and open mind of this educated person. And he acknowledged his indebtedness to people like John Henry Newman and Matthew Arnold with this concept of the liberal arts. Such a person at these Christian colleges would be an antithesis of Matthew Arnold's Philistine. So there's our modern concept of the Philistines. But at the same time that Philistine was being besmirched in the academy in these ways, across the hall, ancient historians began to notice the term for an entirely different reason. As early as the 18th century, it was argued and speculated, really, that the Philistines weren't just any old group, but this group of Philistines were actually displaced Greeks. In about 1856, a decade before Matthew Arnold's discussion of the need for more education, a publication appeared with translations of inscriptions from the Egyptian temple at Medinet Habu. These inscriptions recorded a battle between Ramses III and an invading group of people known as the Pelasset.
This group was immediately recognized by the Egyptologist Champollion as the biblical Philistines, and this was the story of their arrival in Canaan. The Egyptians described the Philistines as a group from a far-off island and described the marauding migration clockwise around the Mediterranean. They destroyed the Hittites, they destroyed North Syria and Cyprus. Then, in the reign of Ramses III, around 1185, the Egyptians thwarted a Philistine invasion of Egypt, leaving them to settle farther to the north. But where was their homeland? Beginning with the work of Heinrich Schliemann at Troy, archaeologists began to realize that these sea peoples were not only from the Aegean, but were likely the Greeks of Homeric legend. While much debate remains about the reliability of Homeric details, the discovery of the robust fortified cities at sites like Troy and Mycenae and other sites have provided evidence that there is at least a vague historical memory behind the later heroic tales. The work in the Aegean was quickly followed up in the Canaan area, the southern Levant, by 20th century excavations at Tel Asafi and Ashkelon and other sites, yielding ceramics contemporary with the Bronze Age Greek ceramics and of a very similar style. The last 50 years of excavation have demonstrated that the ancient Philistines were not uncouth louts fighting against the university students of the day. They were the Homeric apogee of Greek culture and learning. These new sea peoples, these Philistines, were far more artistically and technically advanced than their new neighbors. They had a range of decorative motifs for their pottery, which was unrivaled. Previously, some of the highest artistic productions of the Canaanites had been imitations of earlier Greek imports. Now that the Greeks themselves had arrived, the locals stood little chance. On the earliest pottery, there are delicately rendered motifs. Spiral, streamer, checkerboard, and herringbone patterns compete with fish, birds, and even occasional pictorial scenes. The photo shown here is of the famous Orpheus jug from the Rockefeller Museum in which the musician plays to the animals. The artistic tradition was not static, but gradually incorporated more color, using black and red paint on a white slip to produce stunning decorations that we call Philistine bichrome. We do not know much about Philistine music, as echoes of this practice rarely survive in the archaeological record, but the best single object related to music comes from the Philistine city of Ashdod, the so-called musician's stand. The central musician plays a double flute. He is flanked by two percussionists, one with cymbal, one with tambourine. Farther yet away, another musician on the flute is mirrored by a musician on the lyre. Up until recently, it was thought that this exotic Aegean material culture wilted when this group arrived in Canaan. The Philistines were a small immigrant group with little connection to their homeland. But when we track the development of things like Philistine pottery through time, from the date of their first arrival through the end of the 11th century, so through the 12th and 11th century BC, there's a general trend. Pottery of the Aegean style increases steadily as a percentage of the total assemblage. I would propose that the Philistines were using more things that were more distinctive through time. They weren't wilting in the face of other cultures. There's a Philistine in cultural imperialism that we see in their cities that is very similar to the territorial imperialism noted in the biblical text. When the Philistines arrived, they were not absorbed into a new land. They actively promoted and imposed their cultural practices at the expense of the native practices, and why not? Their ancient traditions were technologically more advanced and artistically superior. Why should they sink to the level of these uncouth, barely educated louts that surrounded them? The Bible provides some indication that the Philistines were a culturally advanced group from Greece, but most of these are hints that were not picked up by biblical scholars until they were re-examined in light of archaeological research. Most directly, Amos 9:7 talks of the Philistines coming from Kaphtor, often identified with Crete, and Deuteronomy 2:7 has a parenthetical reference to a recent immigration from Kaphtor in the region of Philistia. The idea of an Iron Age immigration, however, was obscured by the use of the term Philistine in the stories of Abraham and Isaac, far before the immigration described in Deuteronomy chapter 2. But with the archaeological guide of the 20th century as a spur, some have argued that other elements in the stories of the Philistines betray their origins. Goliath's armor may have some similarities with the armor pictured in Mycenaean drawings. The name for the rulers of the Philistines, Saron in Hebrew, may be related to the Greek Tyrannos. The stories of Samson with their riddles, feasts, super strength, and lonely travels may echo a Homeric cultural setting transplanted to the Levant. None of these connections are certain, however, and many other elements in the description of the Philistines have no Greek echo. The Philistine gods, for instance, Dagon, Ashtoreth, Baal-zebub, have Semitic names, and the Philistine emissaries speak Hebrew in the Bible. For all the cultural achievements of the ancient Philistines visible in the archaeological record, this is not a major focus of the biblical authors. In 1 Samuel, we read, "Not a blacksmith could be found in the whole land of Israel because the Philistines said, 'Otherwise the Hebrews will make swords or spears.' So all Israel went down to the Philistines to have their plow points, mattocks, axes, and sickles sharpened." This has occasioned some comment in the history of interpretation. Most famously, Gregory the Great bemoaned the Hebrews' plight, but he noted that God was able to overcome great obstacles. But as he understood it, he said, look, if God can help them to overcome without these swords and spears and defeat the Philistines, and he sort of viewed that as sort of almost akin to his situation where people would be successful despite a lack of education. He said, if God could do all that without the swords, imagine what he could do with the swords. So he said, this was a call for him for classical education. But in any case, as scholars have rightly pointed out, the Bible focuses primarily on the Philistines as a parade example of the other. They were a people with strange gods, rituals, eating habits, and weaponry. To mirror anything Philistine was the antithesis of Israelite covenant identity for Samson's parents, for Saul, for David. They were the uncircumcised. This uncircumcised threat was most vividly countered in Saul's request to David for 200 foreskins. A good Philistine was a circumcised Philistine by whatever means. Even their land was other. Both Amos and Deuteronomy hinted this idea in their depiction of Philistia as the gift of Yahweh to the Philistines. In defeating the Philistines, all David did was push them back to their boundaries outside the promised land. According to the Bible, when the Philistines fought with the Israelites, they seem to have met with substantial success. They oppressed the people in Judges. They decisively won the Battle of Aphek and captured the Ark temporarily. They established garrisons throughout the hill country. The only respite from this oppression was provided by charismatic leaders operating with divine aid. The Israelite tribes argued that they were at a fundamental structural disadvantage against the Philistines, and they sought to remedy this in 1 Samuel by the creation of a kingship to unify the tribes under a single leader. This was a Canaanite response. The Philistines' political structure was different. So even when faced by the superior organization of the Philistines, the Israelites were not about to imitate them. They adopted the institutions of the nations around them, all the nations, that is, except the hated Philistines. So that's the biblical response. But what about the response that we see of everyday Israelites on the ground? It's important to distinguish between the way the Bible describes the Iron Age and what we see archaeologically in the Iron Age. It is true that the Bible is our best source for that time and that place, but as we read about in the prophets, what the Bible told people to do or said was the right thing to do wasn't what people often did on the ground. The prophets repeat this many, many times. However, in this case, the reaction of Israel to the Philistines was a comprehensive cultural rejection on par with the biblical description of repulsion and otherness. As the Philistines were the ultimate religious other, their cultural feats, however charming and however necessary in some cases, were consciously rejected. In some cases, the cultural rejection visible in the archaeological record has obvious religious overtones. For instance, as people have analyzed the eating patterns in the region through a study of bones recovered in archaeological excavations, and here are for the animal bones, they noticed that there was a sharp difference between the Philistine sites of Ashkelon, Ekron, and others, and the rest of the country. So at Philistine sites, they find that pigs make up almost 20% of the diet, basically indicating that people were eating lots of pig as part of what they were doing. But when you cross the border and you go over a little farther to the east, you find almost no pig production, even though, from an ecological point of view, pigs would grow equally as well. And so you see in that an obvious connection to the Levitical prohibition against eating pig. And so we can see some of those kinds of things rather clearly in the archaeological record. But it isn't just that. We read in the stories in the prophets about the Israelites following other gods. And they do follow other gods, other Canaanite gods, and we find evidence of that in the archaeological record. We don't find evidence of them following Philistine gods. So whatever their other problems, these Philistines were people that they agreed with the biblical text were bad news and the type of people that you should avoid. The response to the Philistines goes further than what can be explained on narrowly religious ground. The Israelites engaged in an artistic and cultural rejection that only the most conservative iconoclast could appreciate. I'll give you a couple examples. At Tel Kasile, which is a site located on the coast, archaeologists have just uncovered the richness of Philistine art. Some of these pieces are from other Philistine sites, but it gives you a general picture of what Philistine style was like. In most cases, the black and red decoration is not even figural. It's merely a series of colorful patterns applied to the exterior. But if we go just 6 miles away across the border, we find something radically different. We find that the pottery has no decoration at all. It is, in fact, a small agricultural village that contented itself with small houses, small storage silos, and very little that rises above the strictly utilitarian. Archaeologists have long noted that there is a striking lack of uniformity and specialization in these early Israelite villages. The pottery is made of poor materials. Almost no two vessels are exactly the same. There were a few sites, particularly in the low-lying hills of the south, that vacillated between the two extremes. As the Samson story describes, it was possible for a young Israelite to be ensnared by the temptations of Philistia. And further, the biblical text also notes that the Philistines were promulgating their culture rather aggressively. Between Israelite waywardness and Philistine aggression, there was some activity at the margins, but this activity was stark. At the site of biblical Timnah, right in the middle of the Sorek Valley between Israelite Beth Shemesh and Philistine Ekron, there's a good example of this interaction. In stratum 6, at the end of the Late Bronze Age, it's clear the town had nothing to do with the Philistines. In stratum 5, which follows, abundant cultural markers show that drove the excavators to argue that this was ruled by the Philistines, a Philistine elite was ruling the Canaanite city. And in stratum 4, dated to the time of David and Solomon, all traces of the Philistines were gone. The Israelites had cleansed the material culture of the city. Even in the midst of these oscillating allegiances, the difference between the Philistines and everyone else is very clearly discernible. My own personal archaeological experiences have emphasized the difference. At the site of Dotan in the West Bank, which I published about 10 years ago, the Philistine fragments could be counted on one hand among the thousands of pieces of pottery from this period, from the 12th to 10th century BC. At Ashkelon, despite a collection of, I think we've counted something like 60,000 pieces from the Iron One at last check, not a single Israelite storage jar has emerged. For all the talk of the middle, the difference is one of the starkest in the archaeology of the Bronze and Iron Ages. Perhaps the Israelites should have taken a more nuanced line. Perhaps they should have followed someone like Francis Schaeffer, who says, "We are not being true to the artist as a man if we consider his artwork junk simply because we differ with his outlook on life. Instead, if the artist's technical excellence is high, he is to be praised for this, even if we differ with his worldview." Or, again, as Leland Ryken has said, "The doctrine of common grace is one of the most important ingredients in the Christian approach to the study and appreciation of the arts." But that's not what happened in this case. Instead, prefiguring T.S. Eliot's view of the culture of a people as an incarnation of their religion, the Israelites entirely rejected the Philistine world. In their rejection of Philistinism, they rejected early Greek art, culture, learning, and cosmopolitan ways of life. They rejected its sophistication and innovation in favor of an iconoclastic, insular, agrarian existence as the people of Yahweh in the Promised Land. Ironically, in the end, they would have agreed with Karl Barth's statement that it is an extreme form of Philistinism to find or be able to find theology distasteful, but to them, these words would have meant something very, very different. It's probably clear as well that the Israelite encounter with the Philistines does not represent the sole biblical model for encountering the art, music, and literature of those who belong to the community of do not belong to the community of faith. At the same time, I hope it's thought-provoking to consider that in the first instance when the people of God saw the Greeks, when Jerusalem was first confronted with Athens, the solution of the Israelites to the problem of Philistinism was not art or music or cultural sophistication or even a Christian college education. They would have valued a good education. They would have valued professional competence. But what they valued most, and what we see most clearly in their encounter with Philistines and Philistinism, was faithfulness to Yahweh, obedience to his word, and being biblically minded. Thank you.